We are Harvard Ventures, and this is The Bottom Line, a podcast about entrepreneurship, innovation, and everything in between. I'm Alex, and today we are speaking with special guest Sam Bankman-Fried, founder and CEO of Alameda Research and FTX Trading. Sam graduated from MIT in 2014 and went straight to Jane Street for 3 years before striking out on his own. With a philanthropic mindset and interest in effective altruism, he and his team founded one of the largest cryptocurrency market makers in the world before deciding to address the lack of a satisfactory decentralized exchange. His first company, Alameda Research, is a quantitative cryptocurrency trading firm and liquidity provider with several billion under management, and is still churning out profits and charitable donations today. More recently, FTX has made headlines disrupting DeFi and finance alike. Already one of the largest cryptocurrency exchanges in the world, FTX still ranks among the fastest growing, with no end in sight. Fed up with poor products, Sam founded FTX to satisfy the world's need for an effective and powerful exchange. He has also taken the product far beyond expectations, branching into derivatives, tokenized stocks, raw goods, and other DeFi sectors he has helped pioneer. Now let's get to the bottom line. What were you like as an MIT undergrad, and what pushed you to Jane Street, into crypto, and on to founding Alameda Research and FTX?
Yeah, I had a really good time at MIT, and I sort of like made a lot of really important connections that are still with me today. I also realized that I didn't want to go into academia, and that I didn't really like school, and so that was like, when it came to actually like academics and classes, I think it like definitely not through any fault of MIT's, but and this is something I probably should have realized earlier, but that definitely put a little bit of a downer in terms of the academic side of it. But on the flip side, it gave me a real chance to think about what I did want to do with my life. And I ended up getting involved in effective altruism as an undergrad and thinking about what I could be doing to have the biggest impact on the world. And that sort of ultimately led me down, down the career path I did end up taking.
That's phenomenal. And, really impressive that, A, you were a physics major at MIT. I don't think that's pretty normal. So we want to ask you, what does your typical day look like, and how do you balance your various projects?
Yeah, there's a lot. And, I think that in the end, sort of like to the extent that there is just like one overriding thing that I think about, and this is a little bit of a non-answer, but I really do think it is the answer. It's, I just think about what makes the most sense. And, sometimes that means having just sort of cached answers in terms of how I spend my time, but often it doesn't. And I think it's really important to be dynamic like that, and to always be thinking about like, am I focusing on the right things? Am I doing the right things? Because, often people aren't, sometimes I'm not. And it's only by being completely willing to, change what I'm thinking about that I can try and actually be thinking about the right things. And so I think that like, what does that actually mean in practice? It means that like some days I will spend, two-thirds of my time thinking about management, about, whether it's, thinking about what I should be doing for employees, whether it's thinking about how I should be structuring, the company, whether it's thinking about hiring or anything else. I'll spend a lot of time thinking about that some days, other days, just not at all. Some days, obviously there's things like this, I do a number of interviews. Some days I'll spend just the whole time talking with developers about, about the product and thinking about, what should we be focusing on product-wise, and not just high level, but I think this is sort of like an important thing for me, is really drilling into it and thinking like low level, like, are we going about this the right way? Should we be changing anything? Often I'll sort of have this sense of like, look, there's this really important thing for the business and it just hasn't been getting done. And I feel like it shouldn't be that hard, but now it's been really important for 2 months and it's still not done. And I think that's like a good time to like, you can say, what's the status of this? And someone says, I'm working on it. And don't just take that as the answer, right? Because like empirically, they may well be working on it, but empirically, whatever's happening isn't the right thing. Like somehow this important thing isn't getting completed in the way it should. And so I think that's an opportunity to say, let's talk more in depth about what that means. Let's talk more in depth about what you've been doing here, about what your approach has been, and about, you know, what you should be doing here. And I think that, like, you know, whether that means like that someone else should be helping on it, whether that means that you should be taking, you know, some shortcut to getting there. Maybe you're trying to solve too hard of a problem. Maybe the right answer is that don't worry about that edge case for now. Just get the basic thing out. You know, or maybe that means there is some weird thing which is really a sticking point that I need to dive in and try and help with. But ultimately, like, my job is for the right things to happen. And it doesn't, you know, it's sort of like a little bit of the buck stops here thing, but, like, you know, I can't say, oh, whatever, that was important for the company. Like, I assigned it to a good employee. It didn't get done, but that's, like, their fault, you know, not mine. Like, that's bullshit. Like, you know, certainly, like our, you know, our users don't care whose quote unquote fault it was. But more generally, like, it's always, even if it's someone else's fault, it's also my fault. And, you know, my ultimate highest responsibility to the company is to make sure that the right things get done, whatever it takes, whether that means, you know, involving myself, whether it means doing it myself, finding someone else to be working on it, talking about it, or sometimes just deciding it doesn't matter that much.
That makes a lot of sense. What do you imagine as the future of crypto? And how do you see DeFi and other sectors evolving in the near future?
Yeah, I don't know for sure. And I think certainly some people are way too confident about the answer to that question and will express, like, this is the future, not just of crypto, but of the world. And I think a lot of these things might be the future of crypto and or the world, but you know, they might not be. I think that, you know, some of the things which I think are just, like, most likely and the most straightforward are, like, crypto payments. You know, I think crypto payments make a ton of sense. The current payment infrastructure is really ugly, and it's easy to forget how ugly it is if you don't focus on it. And you know, it might seem, especially in the States, like, not doing payments isn't that hard. But first of all, you're paying, like, what, like, you know, 3% on credit card fees, or, you know, someone is, every time you buy something at a store, to kind of cover up the fact that there's no easier way to send money. And you know, if you happen to have Venmo and the person next to you happens to as well, then sure, you can pay them with Venmo. If that doesn't happen to be the case, you know, the first time everyone tries to do a wire transfer, it's a really horrific experience. And it's just really instructive about, like, what isn't working well. So that's, I think, the most straightforward and obvious kind of use case that I really do expect to take off. But I think when you look at DeFi, it has really high potential, and I think it could be really awesome and great for the world. And I think that you know, the composable aspect of it is probably the most powerful. The fact that, like, you can have, you know, in theory, someone create an application on chain, basically a business, and then anyone else can just go and natively use it as if they built it themselves. I think that it's just, like, really, really powerful. And that's the sort of thing that can give you kind of exponential growth in businesses, because now all of a sudden you want to build, you know, a retail trading app. Well, you can just compose with an existing decentralized exchange, and it makes it so much easier. So I think DeFi is really high upside, but it's not there. It is not in a good position right now to offer that. And the reason is a bunch of things. I think by far the biggest problem is just the economics and scalability of it. You know, currently most of DeFi is happening on a chain where there are 10 total transactions a second. You know, 10 things total can happen per second in decentralized finance put together. And any single giant business generally is going to take, like, at least tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands or millions of actions per second. And so you can't even get, like, 1% of one big business in DeFi right now, let alone, you know, the future of finance all composing on it. And so I think the biggest thing I would say is, like, scalability absolutely has to be solved before DeFi can actually take off and have much impact on the world. And then once that happens, you know, there's going to be freedom to build more sophisticated apps. And that has to happen as well, because the way that a lot of protocols are designed right now is not actually the most efficient thing you could have. It's just what people have been forced to do because of the transaction limitations.
Makes perfect sense, Sam. We have some questions for you on Solana and Binance Smart Chain later as well. But My next big question for you is, where do you think the consequences of this battle for U.S. regulation are going to end up? And I mean, to clarify that for some of our listeners, we all hope that cryptocurrencies can remain independent and, you know, barring stable coins, largely unregulated. But how do you think governments are actually going to give way to allowing, you know, a large currency, and if not the main global currency, to be completely out of their control?
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing to say is, first of all, obviously it's going to be different in different countries. But in the States, there's a big difference between saying that a currency itself is unregulated and saying that operating a centralized business which offers transactions in that currency is unregulated. And, you know, my best guess is that we see one but not the other. And that where this ends up basically is a world where Bitcoin itself is independent and unregulated. And on the other hand, if you want to run an exchange that offers to swap US dollars for Bitcoin with traders, you're going to have to, you know, pay attention to AML KYC regulations, you know, money transmitting legislation, and potentially other things. That's my guess about where all this ends up, is that, well, other than, as you said, stable coins, most of the core cryptocurrencies themselves don't get sort of like natively regulated, that, you know, anything that is touching fiat currency could impact, you know, money laundering concerns, that those businesses that handle crypto get regulated. Obviously, I don't know for sure, but I think that's the most likely outcome. And, you know, I think that we've seen a big shift in regulators' attitude towards crypto in the US, but also elsewhere over the last year, you know, away from, I think regulators sort of like, you know, given up on, you know, they've given up on like, you know, maybe it'll just go away and we'll never have to deal with it. Like, it's just gotten big enough that looks like it's not going to happen. And instead, where we sort of ended up is much more of a realm where it's probably too big to be reasonably banned. And I think most regulators are not looking to ban crypto, but where it's also too big to be fully unregulated as an industry. And so we're going to end up in a place where regulators are trying to strike a balance of having there be licensing and regulation in crypto without, you know, forcing all businesses offshore. You know, obviously we'll see how effective that is, but my guess is that that's going to be where people are aiming.
Those are some really great clarifications, especially on the regulation front. And so we also wanted to ask you, how will China's recent interference and crackdowns in the crypto space affect the future of crypto mining, trading, and the whole of the decentralized finance space? Sorry.
Totally. Well, I think the first and most straightforward thing is a lot of crypto is moving out of China. And that's sort of like the obvious answer. I think, you know, you've seen this most clearly with hash rate, where, you know, China has for a while been the epicenter of Bitcoin mining. And that looks like it actually might just change now. Like, you know, by and large, a ton of large Bitcoin miners are just saying, all right, you know, that's that. Like, I guess we're not going to be a Chinese-based company anymore, because China doesn't want that industry. And so that's sort of the clearest implication is, is mining going offshore. And I think it's probably not just going to be mining. I think there are a lot of ways in which we're going to see more and more of the crypto industry moving out of China. And we already have seen that to some extent over the last few years. The other thing I would say is that, you know, I don't think that this is Chinese regulators saying, here's our final stance on crypto. We are going to crush it with every ounce that we have forever. I think it's a lot more dynamic than that. And this is a little bit different than the type of signaling that US regulators would use here. But I think generally when you see big crackdowns in China on something, it's not an ultimate statement, you know, forever on that thing. It is sort of relative to the current environment. And so I think the right interpretation of this is something closer to, look, you know, the Chinese government isn't happy with some aspects of the industry right now and is going to, do what it takes to nudge it in a direction that it is happier with, without sort of trying to comment on whether or not I think that's a good thing, but I think that's probably the direction they're going to be going in. And, you know, it wouldn't be shocking if a month from now they were giving really pro-crypto statements. And because it's not, I think, an ultimate anti-crypto thing, I think it's especially when it comes to matters of monetary policy, they have really strong opinions on how it happens. And, you know, anything that touches R&B, they have really strong opinions on. And I think they're worried, you know, I don't want to put words in their mouth, but I'm guessing that they're worried about losing, you know, about things that would threaten to sort of like undermine their control of national currency. And they want to make sure that they remain regulatory control there. So that's my best guess about how, you know, Chinese regulators are thinking about this. Again, you know, want to make statements that are too strong here, but I would definitely caution against reading too much long-term into this and instead thinking of this in the context of how they very locally see the industry.
Well, I mean, I guess it doesn't really matter where companies are based since a lot of the stuff is decentralized to begin with, right? But
to some extent, that's absolutely true. You know, I mean, it's more true here than it is in most industries.
All right. I mean, I'm just curious on a personal level, where do you think a lot of companies are going to end up in the end? Like, is there going to be a Silicon Valley for crypto somewhere? Or
it's a really interesting question. And I'm going to be honest, right now, very few countries are raising their hands to take that on. Very few countries are doing what it would take to become that Silicon Valley of crypto. You know, I think Miami has tried, but there's a limit, and I think it's been great and they have had real impact. There's also a limit to how much a city can do in the States, because a lot of this is federal regulation. And so, you know, I think that there's a chance it ends up as the States. I think that's an absolute possibility. I think Singapore is an absolute possibility here. You know, I think Singapore is trying to be that place, and I think they're giving a good faith attempt. There's also a lot more that has to be done in terms of clarifying, you know, regulation, especially around derivatives and DeFi there. And we're going to have to see how that plays out. I think there's a lot of smaller countries that are also aiming for this. You know, I think Gibraltar, Bahamas, Bermuda are all looking at trying to become hubs of, you know, sort of natively digital finance. And, you know, I think you might see sort of regional hubs popping up there, which have significant impact on the space. You know, you could imagine it like Switzerland doing this, although it has to contend with a pretty difficult regulatory environment in Europe more generally, which I think limits how much will happen there in the short run. But, you know, I think long run, it really is an open question where this hub ends up. And no jurisdiction has sort of like done what it would take to make it clear that that was going to be the answer, so to speak.
Makes perfect sense. How long do you think it will take for the yield farming and staking bubbles first?
Yeah, I mean, look, I would have said a few weeks, a year and a half ago. So, I mean, you know, clearly I'm off on something there. But I think that like, we're going to see it returning more to like more reasonable levels. I think we already have seen it return in general to more reasonable levels. Like yield is substantially lower now in DeFi than it was, you know, than it was a year ago. And so I think we're going to continue to see that settle down a little bit. But one, I think, underexplored piece of this is that that wasn't the only place in crypto you could get yield. You could get it with futures and borrow lending markets as well. And really what was going on at its core, in addition to sort of yield farming, which I think is like a little bit of a wacky system that wasn't super well understood by a lot of people, is that for the last 2 years, maybe a year and a half, actually even less than that, really since like, you know, the crypto rally during COVID started, there's been a lot of indications that a number of institutions are looking to get involved in crypto. And you know, I think this is just true. Like we've talked to a lot of institutions, they all say the same things, which is, look, we don't know exactly what we want to do, but we want to do something here. You know, we want to get involved in the space. We don't want to be left behind. And, you know, they don't know exactly what that's going to mean long term. But what this means is that there's been a ton of anticipated demand for crypto that hasn't yet materialized, but that sort of the space strongly expects will materialize over the next, say 3 years. And a lot of people were trying to get leveraged long in anticipation of that. Now that led to some of the crash, I think, in terms of the leverage that led to the liquidations. But what it also means is that continuously for the last year, we've seen absolutely massive demand to borrow dollars in crypto in order to get longer. And that ends up flowing through to the entire ecosystem in super interesting ways. Because, you know, let's say that there are a bunch of people who have, $1 trillion of wealth, but want to be long $2 trillion of cryptocurrency. They need to find a way to leverage up, whether they're borrowing dollars or getting long futures. One way or another, they're getting leverage long, and someone is giving them that leverage. Someone is basically donating them the capital in order to get long. They're going to charge for that, and there's way more demand than supply. And so over the last, over the last year, what we've seen is absolutely massive demand to borrow USD and to get long, really high future, positive futures premiums because of this, high interest rates, and that you can, you could have made, 50% or so annualized if you just got long spot crypto, short futures, and did that arbitrage, or if you yield farmed, or if you lent out your dollars in a, crypto bar lending market, or any number of other things. And so actually secretly, a lot of these sources of edge in crypto were all coming from the same core place, which was people trying to get long and willing to pay 50% annualized to do so. And, that's a lot of money to be made, but also obviously if you'd done that and didn't get liquidated, you'd be up 3X this year. And so, it certainly ended up being a good trade to be the ones borrowing there.
You're so right. Big institutions are getting involved, especially with large companies starting their own versions like JP Morgan creating JPM Coin. But how do you think quantum computing and other new technology will affect the security of blockchains, not just for the use of currencies, but in every regard?
Yeah. So, there's sort of this worry, so far it's just a theoretical one, but, which is what would happen if someone were able to actually, basically like a lot of variants on, if they're able to crack the hashing algorithm on Bitcoin or on other major cryptocurrencies to the point where they could actually just basically trivially, reverse engineer someone's secret key or there are a lot of variants on it, but they all sort of sound something like that. And, it's not something which has happened so far. It's not something that there are indications that's like, it's about to happen, but it's something you have to think about long-term in terms of, are we on the right path? Like what's the future for this? I think that like, it's not something the industry has to figure out now. And the reason for this is, if worse comes to worse and some of these algorithms, and people do get, I think it's unlikely that's going to happen overnight is basically my core thought. I think it's unlikely someone's going to wake up one day and be like, aha, now we've cracked crypto. I think it's more likely that what you'd see is more and more indications that it might happen. And I'm not sure it ever is going to happen, but maybe it will. And if that does happen, if you see, quantum computers start to get powerful enough that it looks like they might actually be able to render some blockchains insecure, the world can always switch chains to chains that are, are resilient against that. And so that's like my basic thought here that like, you absolutely can't forget about it. But I don't think it's something that the world needs to think too hard about right now, as long as, the world makes sure that if it does start to become imminent, that we don't just like let whoever cracks it steal everyone's crypto.
Yeah, I mean, that really is just the name of the game, isn't it, right now? So do you think the dominant yep. crypto of the future is already here? Like, is there a currency that's going to take the reins that 80%? Isn't here yet?
So I'm going to ignore for the purposes of this, stable coins or tokenized assets, which are, they're a different sort of thing. I think stable, there might be a new stable coin which gets absolutely huge. That's sort of a different thing though than like a new native currency that gains, native value. I would say the odds are that, 20 years from now, the biggest cryptocurrency that's not a wrapped asset by market cap is a token that it already existed in 2021. I don't know, 80% is like roughly my ballpark guess. I'm obviously bullshitting on that. I don't know exactly what the odds are, but you could see something new come and take that place. I think the problem you're going to run into is there's huge resistance against changing what sort of the agreed upon store of value is, because everyone in crypto sort of loses money if that happens, so to speak. Like they put so much wealth into Bitcoin and other major cryptocurrencies, and all of a sudden those are just sort of like deemed irrelevant. So there's going to be a lot of resistance against that. That doesn't mean it can't happen. But I think that it's, it's not something which I think will just sort of like happen by accident. I think there would need to be a pretty compelling reason to cause it to happen.
So something like Sol maybe, or Radium, Serum. I mean, Serum's one that you're obviously very focused on with FTX and Alameda both being large investors. Something I've been following a lot as well. But do you think that Binance Smart Chain and Solana are kind of the kings of the Ethereum killers right now?
I think that if you had to name current blockchains, that's what most people would say are the most likely. And, you know, obviously that's sort of like, it's not clear exactly how it's going to play out. And they, you know, these may end up in harmony as opposed to competition. You can imagine a multi-chain world. But I think that there's a ton of cryptocurrencies that have tried to become, you know, the major smart chain. And I think what you've seen again and again is that there are just a lot that don't quite paint a compelling enough case to be the one. And that I think part of the problem is, you know, if you have absolutely massive adoption, which BSC has by virtue of Binance's user base, that's sort of one reason that that you could win, right? Is just by virtue of like having a huge built-in number of users. Another way that you could imagine winning is by building tech that will scale and that will really work long run. But I think almost no blockchains other than Solana have done that. And I think in particular, what you run into is that like sort of the level that you'd need to hold a blockchain to for it to be the long-term answer. I think you sort of need to think that there's going to be millions of transactions a second ultimately happening on it. Millions is a big number, but I really do think you need that, because that's like when you look at, you know, how many transactions a second do Facebook, New York Stock Exchange, you know, Twitter, Weibo, like whatever you want to look at. Any massive company, not any, but most massive companies, you know, any company with billions of users is going to have at least, you know, hundreds of thousands to millions of transactions a second. So I think you need to get up to that level. And I think that almost no current cryptocurrencies, you know, almost no current blockchains other than Solana are even trying to get to that level. I think for most of them, when they say that they're sort of like fast and scaling, what they mean is like 3,000 transactions a second, which is a lot more than what you see right now in terms of the most used chains, but it's just still not close to enough. And it's not just that they don't have enough right now. It's not on the roadmap to get enough. It's not part of the sort of like vision. They're not thinking about how to get there. And so because of that, I'm sort of skeptical that most other blockchains are going to really be the long-term answer that exists right now. Now you could see one that doesn't exist right now gaining huge market share if it ends up with absolutely amazing tech, you know, better than any that are built right now. And I don't want to sort of rule that out, but I'm sort of skeptical that most other existing blockchains are going to be the long-term answer because of that.
Having used your products, I can see that you clearly have the best in-class product, but how did you decide to buy the new FTX Arena rights, the TSN gaming team and MLB rights, and more recently, a partnership with Tom Brady? Can you give us
I super appreciate that. And, you know, I think that the biggest thing from our perspective is, you know, we do feel like we have the best products, and that's sort of what's driven the company the whole time. And, you know, everything that we've been able to do, either it's been our products or it's been enabled by our products. On the other hand, we are, I mean, you know, Brian Armstrong, CZ, and a number of other players made an absolutely phenomenal business decision, which was to get involved in a crypto exchange in, you know, whatever, 2013, 2014, 2015. And I was dicking around playing League of Legends in college then. And just a less excellent business decision. Because of that, you know, they've had years to build up a really massive user base that FTX hasn't. And so I think a lot of what we're thinking about is, what can we do now that will really have the capacity to reach theoretically tens of millions of users? And not just like in theory reach them, but do so in a way which is sort of compelling. We really don't want to dilute our brand and end up with sort of like, you know, hard to describe mush or something like that. And so, you know, I think that because of that, like, we've been thinking a lot about what the most compelling things we can do are. And I think this is sort of what we ended up with, was that there are some partnerships that are just way, way higher profile and more exciting than most. And that that was really what we were going to focus on. I think on the other hand, you know, you see some partnerships, endorsements, advertisements go up. You sort of look at them, they're so obviously inauthentic. And it's so obvious that no one involved really cares about the partnership that, like, I can't help but thinking, like, you haven't convinced your best friend, you haven't convinced your family to take care about whatever this product or company is. Like, that was just, like, obviously you're just being paid to say some lines. And I think that's not really the thing that, you know, while we do want mass appeal, we don't want to dilute the brand that we've built in doing it. We don't want to just become completely bland and generic, because then I think we will have just lost what we are trying to gain. And so I think what we've been looking for are, like, what are partnerships that are, like, really exciting, where the partner is going to be excited about us and working with us on this, and that are really going to, you know, be exciting for potential users and capture people's imagination.
I mean, that really is just, that's where you're headed, right? You have to get this awesome product you guys have internationally and market it to American consumers. Personally, I really would have loved to have you at the other American Airlines center in Dallas here. I think our other guest, Mr. Cuban, would have loved to have you, you know,
put a little FTX logo on. Oh, I would love to be there. I would love to do that too. And, you know, he's a cool guy.
Yes, sir. All right, Virginia, you're up.
So pivoting a little here, what role do you think the FTX Foundation will be in terms of able to grow into a charitable organization? And how will it go beyond growing a source of humanitarian funding?
Yeah, and I think that, like, we want to be dynamic with it, and we want to, you know, be thinking about what the highest impact things we can do are. And so, you know, I don't want to make too specific of predictions about it, but I think there are a few big things we're thinking about it. One is just an opportunity to do a lot of good. Although, frankly, you know, it's probably not how I'm going to end up donating the largest amount. Like, I think I'm probably going to end up giving more independently than ends up being given directly through the foundation. But I think a big thing that we wanted to do with it, in addition to just directly doing good with the donations, is really to try and get the community involved, to try and, you know, not force anyone to do anything, but set an example for the rest of the ecosystem about what you can do to make the world better. You know, hopefully spread some ideas about it, get some engagement, get other people thinking about it, give people an easy avenue to get involved. And I've been, like, really shocked actually by how involved people have gotten. I was sort of not expecting this level, but you know, as of today, like, our users have given over $7 million through it, which is sort of humbling. And I think that's, like, one of the other big things that we're thinking about with the foundation.
Your start in effective altruism is truly inspiring to us, and I'm sure the rest of the world is happy to hear your intentions. One question we like to ask all of our guests is, what is your hottest take or most controversial opinion?
Oh boy. I mean, certainly not something I'd say publicly, almost by definition, but let me give you a better answer than that. That's a pretty bad answer. All right. What is my most controversial opinion? And I have a bunch of opinions in crypto, which I think are pretty publicized at this point and maybe aren't totally mainstream. I think, you know, certainly, like, my thoughts on blockchains are amongst them. And, you know, I certainly think that, like, that scalability is just incredibly important, and that it's not just, like, a factor, but that it's the dominant factor at this point. And if you don't solve that, sort of nothing can make up for it. So I think that's one piece of this, which I do think is important. And is probably, you know, a bit outside the norm, but I don't think it's sort of, like, the most interesting opinion. I think it's just sort of maybe one thing I'll say is, and I wrote up some thoughts about this around the end of the year, but when you think about what maximizes your expected value in your impact on the world in whatever business you're building, or whatever, actually just like most domains, not all domains, but most of them. You know, when you think about how to maximize expected value, I think a lot of people default to thinking about sort of median outcomes, or, you know, maybe 75th percentile outcomes or something. But I think a lot of people think about this in terms of like, what's my best guess about what's going to happen? And I think that's not where most of the expected value is. I think most of the expected value is in the tails. I think most of the expected value is in the cases where things go better than just well. It's in the cases where things go spectacularly. And I think that's true just across a lot of different domains. I think that actually just has like really powerful implications for what you should do with your life. I think it means that you should take seriously arguments about tail cases, even if they seem unlikely. Because yeah, they're unlikely, that's true. But you know, if the payoff is high enough, that's okay that they're unlikely. And it means accepting that you might fail. It might even mean accepting you'll probably fail. And that can be scary. But I think it's sometimes the right thing to do. You know, I think that like in retrospect, I think we actually were decently likely to succeed at it, but certainly when we founded FTX, we didn't think it was going to succeed. You know, we thought 80% chance the business would just never get traction. And like in particular, what we thought was going to happen was that we might build the best product, but no one would ever use it. And we never even figure out how to get people to use it. And it just sort of like die, you know, a sort of boring death. And that didn't end up happening, but we thought it would, and we went for it anyway, because it basically seemed so high upside. Like, you know, the benefit to doing it well was so big that it was worth going for, even though it would probably fail. And, you know, I think that in general, these arguments can seem weird and scary, and it's easy to abuse them, and it's easy to do bad or crazy or stupid things or doomed things, convincing yourself that maybe there's a 10% chance they succeed and the payoff is huge. But that if you really do have sound arguments for why you think there really is a 10% chance of success, yeah, I think sometimes the answer is just like, that's right. You know, this thing's probably going to fail, and it's absolutely what you should do. Because the payoff is so much bigger than the payoff if you're to do something safe. And I think that that's true. You know, it's true in terms of like whenever you're starting a new company, if you think the odds are it's going to succeed, that's not a good thing. If you think the odds are your company's going to succeed, that means you are not being ambitious enough with your company. Like, that means you're shooting too low, and probably you're overconfident, but also it's just not going to be huge. And what you should instead do is shoot for the company that there is no reason it couldn't succeed. You can see a path to success, but your best guess is it's decently unlikely. That's sort of where you should be shooting, I think, when you start a new initiative, in most cases. And I think that when you're looking at having impact on the world, this is true as well. I think especially through donations, and this is, I think, a little bit of another weird point, but I think a really important one, is you should donate in many cases in ways where in the 50th percentile case, your donations have no impact. And the reason for this is that's not what matters. Like, what matters is the expected value of the impact that you have. And you know, some donations that you could have are all in the upside and might revolutionize the world, but probably will have no impact. And that's totally fine. And it's actually even better than from the company side. From the company side, you're a person, you need to eat, right? If your company fails, that kind of sucks for you. And so you do have some sublinearity there. When you're looking at impacting the world, like, the world does not have sublinear utility of utility, or anything like that. And the scale of money that you would need to start not being able to donate effectively is like $1 trillion. So really, you can shoot really high before you start hitting those diminishing marginal returns. And, you know, if you have a program that has a 1% chance of saving 1,000 people or 100% chance of saving 5 people, I think you should do the first, even though there's a 99% chance it's going to fail. And even if that's all you're ever going to do with your life, you should accept that 99% chance of failure to have had any impact on the world, because it was worth it. It's what had the biggest impact and expectation. And, you know, I think there's sort of some arguments you can think through to convince yourself that that probably has to be the right answer. But it can be scary to know that it might all be for naught. I also think it's super important.
And that's the bottom line. Thank you so much for listening. If you like this podcast, please be sure to find us online at harvardventures.org. If you're a company or individual interested in working with us, email us at hello@harvardventures.org and follow us on Instagram @harvard_ventures. Tune in next week for another episode of The Bottom Line.